In a couple of days it will be November the 11th, the time when we say, lest we forget. And this year, marking the centenary of the beginning of that first global industrialised conflict, is especially significant. It also has implications at a distance for our understanding of the human mind. How you get young men to obey by treating them like unthinking rats or robots. The history is bleak, as Dr. John Carmody remembers. He's a physiologist and historian at the University of Sydney.
The novel Augustus, by the American writer John Williams, tells the story of the great emperor through the imagined letters, journals, and memoirs of his contemporaries and family. In reflecting on the Battle of Actium, in which the fleet of Mark Antony and Cleopatra was routed by the Roman force under his command, Marcus Agrippa writes in his journal, "We knew that we had won the world, but there were no songs of victory that night, nor joy among any of us. Late into the night, the only sound that could be heard was the lap and hiss of water against the burning hulls and the low moans of the wounded. A glow of burning hung over the harbour, and Caesar Augustus, his face stark and reddened in that glow, stood at the prow of his ship and looked upon the sea that held the bodies of those brave men, both comrade and foe, as if there were no difference between them." Just as then, during World War I, the essential differences were not between the fighting men in the field, but between those who drove them there. Whereas Octavius had a clear purpose at Actium, what purpose was there in that later war of industrial scale? It is difficult to know. In his recent book, The Sleepwalkers, Professor Christopher Clark, the Australian scholar at Cambridge, has an apt summary. The protagonists of 1914 were sleepwalkers, watchful but unseeing, haunted by dreams, yet blind to the reality of the horror they were about to bring into the world. In a letter to Venetia Stanley, the British Prime Minister Herbert Asquith wrote on the 28th of July 1914, "We all drift on in a kind of dull, cataleptic trance." To historians of neuroscience, those words have a fin de siècle ring to them. Unseeing sleepwalkers, cataleptic trance, dreams. Freud had published Studies on Hysteria in 1895 and the interpretation of dreams only 15 years before the outbreak of the war. Other neuroscientists were, in the preceding decades or so, formulating our modern concepts. The mechanisms of cellular electricity, the application of the notion of cellular individuality to the nervous system, the basis of neuronal communication, the coining of such new words as neuron, synapse, and hormone. At the same time, the second industrial revolution and the invention of the assembly line transformed manufacturing, reducing the importance of individual men and women in the production of goods. Everything and everyone was becoming a machine. Cells and people were transformed into components of processes. Only a proper command system was needed. The idea of the brain, or its social analogue, at the head of that system seemed to suit that zeitgeist. But at the time, that social brain was autocratic and oligarchic, really, with women mostly excluded. The common people were in much the same degraded state in all of the countries which went to war. They were commodities. This zeitgeist appeared in seemingly more respectable form exactly 100 years ago, with the publication of John B. Watson's book Behaviour, An Introduction to Comparative Psychology, which influenced, many would say blighted, American psychology for at least the next 50 years. Watson was at pains to expunge any trace of philosophy, which he thought had distorted his nascent discipline for too long. Yet his view of psychology was no less embedded in philosophy than those whom he was attacking. It was also an unpleasant philosophy. There are many contentious assertions in Watson's book. Though the competition is fierce, the worst of them to me is his ex-cathedra declaration that, quote, "the behaviourist recognises no dividing line between man and brute." The wording is troubling, and leaves me unsurprised about the brutality of the Great War, which began at just that time. It is of a piece with what his protege B.F. Skinner wrote years later, denying that a person is an initiating doer, actor, or causer of behaviour, and that the behaviour of a person is good if it is effective under prevailing contingencies of reinforcement. Skinner is, if I might put it that way, reinforcing Watson's view that our learning is purely behavioural or operant. In particular, Watson's view that psychology must discard all reference to consciousness because, quote, one can assume either the presence or the absence of consciousness anywhere in the phylogenetic scale without affecting the problems of behaviour by one jot or tittle. There is, in other words, no scope for moral decision-making in Watson's world, where a man cannot, psychologically, be distinguished from a rat or a fox. That view of the world was powerfully taken up by his psychologist contemporaries and others in American society. Elsewhere too. Lest you think that I'm overstating my concerns by moving too easily from the laboratory to human society, I might mention the American psychologist and historian of psychology, John A. Mills, who wrote, quote, "We now know enough to say with confidence that psychological behaviorism arose not within psychology itself, but within American society from about the 1880s onwards." He also observed that there was a symbiotic relationship between social scientists and the intellectual lay public, and that behaviorism was the soil nourishing early American social science. The title of his book is telling, Control, A History of Behavioral Psychology, because over 80 years earlier, Watson had baldly stated that the theoretical goal of psychology is the prediction and control of behavior. The USA did not formally enter the Great War until April 1917, of course, and I'm certainly not implying that the British and French leadership were directly influenced by Watson. None of the British leadership had ever studied psychology. Their decision-making seemed to be an odious blend of local politics, whether or not to act on treaties, posturing by individual members of the cabinet about their honour, and atavistic British bellicosity. As Asquith wrote to Venetia Stanley on the 3rd of August 1914, war or anything that seems likely to lead to war is always popular with the London mob. There are serious psychological questions there. So what of the German political and military situation? Whereas Watson and his colleagues sought to expunge the philosophical influence from psychology, it was persistent in German thinking. The father of German psychology, Wilhelm Wundt, took a broad view. Quote, "Psychology investigates the whole content of experience in its relations to the subject and in its attributes derived directly from the subject." In elaboration, he said, "Psychology investigates the contents of experience in their complete and actual form, both the ideas that are referred to as objects and all the subjective processes that cluster about them. Its knowledge is, therefore, immediate and perceptual. Perceptual in the broad sense of that term, in which not only sense perceptions, but all concrete reality is distinguished from all that is abstract and conceptual in thought." That linkage is in stark contrast to Watson's dogma. So too was the German philosopher Hegel's argument when he wrote rather earlier, "Spirit is thought in general, and the human being is distinguished from the animal by thought. But it must not be imagined that a human being thinks on the one hand and wills on the other. The distinction between thought and will is simply that between theoretical and practical attitudes. This, be it philosophy or psychology, is highly relevant to decisions about warfare." Hegel recognized that important decisions must be made on more defensible criteria than ancient reading of the entrails, or their more modern counterparts, because, quote, "at that time, self-consciousness had not yet arrived at the abstraction of subjectivity, nor had it yet realized that an I will must be pronounced by man himself on the issue to be decided." Whether the politicians of the Germany of 1914 had studied Hegel or Wundt was probably irrelevant, because it seems that the real power in the country was held by the senior officers of the German military, who were unlikely to have studied those scholars. Furthermore, the Kaiser was by then essentially a mere symbol, putty in their hands, and there was a lust for war in many German and Austrian quarters. The German diplomat and cultural activist Graf Harry Kessler wrote in his diary on the 31st of July, "In Berlin, huge crowds sway back and forth on Unter den Linden, composed of small troops of adolescent girls and boys who march and sing patriotic songs." Next day he wrote, "In the afternoon at 6, the mobilization was announced. You could breathe. The sultry pressure gave way, and a cool determination took its place. In the night, the Friedrichstrasse, Linden, the square in front of the palace were filled by a mighty crowd of people, from time to time singing Deutschland, Deutschland über alles, or the Watch on the Rhine, and waving hats." On the 5th of August, the day after Britain declared war, he wrote, "The entire population from Berlin to Birkholz gives the impression that they have completely lost their minds." This echoes what the British ambassador in Vienna had reported to London on the 24th of July. War is thought imminent. Wildest enthusiasm prevails in Vienna. Perhaps such mass demonstrations are an aspect of what Wundt had in mind when he wrote about Völkerpsychologie, communal psychology. Intellectuals were no less susceptible to it than the great unwashed. Early in the Great War, Wundt was one of the academic, artistic and theological signatories of the notorious propaganda known as the Manifesto of the 93 of the 23rd of October 1914. Those blindly zealous patriots sought to deny the charges of barbarism by the German army as it swept across Belgium in the early weeks. Acts such as the undeniable burning down of the renowned university library in Louvain. Others, on the side of the Triple Entente, likewise let patriotism vanquish their own academic integrity. Whatever their motivations and morals, the leadership of all parties in the Great War seemed entirely unconcerned by the human costs of what they were doing. As a consequence, one outcome was at least 16 million deaths, 10 million of them military personnel. Soldiers were thrown at the fronts like coals being shoveled into a fire. It was Watson at work. Those men were considered no more valuable than rats or mice. They were objects, not human souls. Or, as the British poet Wilfred Owen wrote in his 1917 poem, Anthem for Doomed Youth, "What passing bells for those who die as cattle." If there is one lesson here, it is how susceptible we all are to the power of the Zeitgeist. Education lays a veneer over our emotions, but it is dangerously thin.
Yes, it is remarkably easy to manipulate young men to do anything. Treat people like rats? Well, you know. November the 11th, Armistice Day, is on Tuesday. And there's more on minds and philosophy at 5 p.m. today as Lynn Malcolm presents All in the Mind and Joe Gelonesi gives us the Philosopher's Zone straight after on RN. Next week at this time, Robin Robertson goes to the Arctic Circle. I'm Robin Williams.